This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised. This is True Crime XS. In the popular television show House, the lead character, a renowned doctor named Gregory House, known for his curmudgeonly ways, says that everybody lies. The show then goes on to show you examples of where people are lying and examples of people where they were not. This particular case has been described as this killer's fourth victim. It created a problem from very early in the investigation. The case that I'm going to tell you about today is about what might be a lie and what might be the truth. This episode is split into two parts. The first part is trying to determine how a particular victim may or may not fit into the story. The second part is delving deeper into the alternatives.
Deborah Feldman was last seen alive back on April 8, 2009. The following day, the 49-year-old Hackensack woman disappeared without a trace. Now the FBI believes that she was killed by a notorious serial killer who admitted to 11 murders across the country. Keyes told federal agents that he grabbed a woman believed to be Feldman, then drove her across multiple state lines, strangled her, and buried her body near Lake Tupper in the Adirondacks in upstate New York. Her body was never recovered.
I would have preferred to wait until they find the bodies in Vermont, but it sounds like that could be a while.
Keyes' bloody crime spree ended in March 2012. That's when he was collared for the murder of Samantha Koenig, a beautiful 18-year-old waitress in Anchorage, Alaska, a brutal crime that made national headlines at the time. The FBI said Keyes chose his victims randomly and didn't know any of them personally. The 34-year-old confessed serial killer gave agents names and details on several cases before committing suicide in his jail cell December 1st, 2012.
The serial killer Israel Keyes is at times seen smiling in 2012 FBI interrogation videos as he described or alluded to killing 11 people. Investigators now believe 48-year-old Deborah Feldman may have been one of his victims after his reaction to seeing her picture.
One of the photos that he was shown was a photo of Deborah Feldman. And when he got to that photograph, he made the statement that he didn't want to talk about that. He didn't deny it.
The Hackensack woman disappeared in April 2009. Investigators say before he committed suicide in jail last year, Keyes confessed to abducting a woman from the East Coast one day after Feldman was last seen. They say he transported the victim over multiple state lines before killing and burying her body in upstate New York.
We're trying to identify individuals that may have seen him in the area. Seen Israel Keyes with Deborah Feldman.
Keyes was arrested in 2012 for the murder of an 18-year-old barista in Anchorage, Alaska. He told investigators he had kidnapped and murdered victims ranging from teenagers to the elderly as far back as 2001 while traveling across the country as a contractor.
As a strategy, it's a kind of a smart strategy for killing.
Forensic psychologist N.G. Burrell has not worked on the Keyes case, but has spent years studying serial killers. Burrell says he wouldn't be surprised if Keyes is linked to even more murders.
If this fellow was as effective and skillful as he appears to be in terms of his killing, then it may be for years to come, long after his death, that they're going to be able to link some missing people to him.
Feldman's body has never been found. Investigators are asking anyone who may have any information about her disappearance or may have seen Keyes in the area around the time of her disappearance to contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. Again, that's 1-800-CALL-FBI. In Hackensack, New Jersey, Checky Beckford, News 4 New York.
From Meg's original report, what do we do about Deborah Feldman? I have other cases, cases that hinge on whether or not we include her. There are several cases in Oregon, like Deborah Honey and Kimberly Forbes, that we need to talk about. I have a classification for this type of victim, but if you're not going to include her, then we need to do something about how we tell her story. She's included in all the other reference materials, and the FBI has stated they consider her to be the fourth known victim. If you have thoughts on this, we need to talk about them. But I can't specifically write any conclusions about Deborah Feldman.
I personally think that Israel Keyes was attracted to blondes. I don't know, except for my observations, I don't really have any factual evidence of that. But I feel like he looked for adult women, Abedi, adult women who he would have had to have had a weapon on them to take them. And like, they weren't going to buy the ransom. They wouldn't have believed that. And they wouldn't have tolerated like being pushed around with somebody by someone unless they really felt like they could be hurt. These are a sliding scale. And so it's like female, and you go, because it sort of characterizes, you know, a typical female personality. When you're young, you're very vulnerable and easily convinced, and you don't know to talk somebody out of murdering you. I laugh because it's terrible to think about, but I mean, it's true. And then, you know, when you're a teenage girl, you want to be polite and not cause any problems. Well, then you get to be a little older. You don't care if you're causing problems or not. You have enough at stake that you don't want to be randomly killed by some guy who will more than likely let you go, at least you hope.
And when you developed the Betty profile, was that in line with, you know, and I know we go back and forth on this with differing opinions, but Deborah Feldman, was that where you started with that one?
Yes. Well, I mean, in a way.
And I have your list of victims that fit that, so I can put those in here. If you would like to remind you, there's one particular one I'm hoping you might remember a little bit about, and that's Deborah Honey.
Well, Deborah Honey and Deborah Feldman in some ways looked very similar to each other. They were different in some ways, but in some ways they looked very similar.
Deborah Ann Honey Hooks was last seen on Pulyup Avenue in Tacoma, Washington, during the evening hours of November 6, 2002. She may have tried to call her family 9 days later, on November 15, but they have had no contact with her since then. She frequented the SeaTac Strip in the Pioneer Square area of Seattle, Washington. She may have been seen on Pacific Highway in Seattle, Tacoma, during mid-December 2002. Honey Hooks was involved in drugs and prostitution at the time of her disappearance, and investigators believe she may have met with foul play. Her case remains unsolved. She was 41 years old, 5'7" tall, 97 pounds. She was wearing a black jacket, a black and white sweater, a white shirt, gray sweatpants, and white shoes. She has blonde hair and brown eyes. She may use her last names together or separately. Her ears are pierced. She's a biracial African-American and Caucasian female.
And so my thought was, because I have like a group of Pebbles and then a group of Bettys. And Deborah Feldman and Deborah Honey were definitely inspiration for the Betty characterization. Deborah Feldman is the 2009 April victim.
Yes, she's Hackensack, New Jersey, thought to have been
potential.
Like three states, right, potentially.
Yeah, so that's where she kind of comes into play. And yes, in my mind, Betty is Deborah Feldman. And also in my mind, the likelihood, I feel like if he abducted and killed Deborah Feldman, he probably abducted and killed Deborah Honey, and vice versa.
Okay.
Because I can't remember exactly why, but it made sense. When I was doing the research on this case, those cases were a lot alike. The people were a lot alike. The ladies were, those Deborahs fell into the category, and I could totally see him being responsible for both of those, or neither of them. I mean, it's based on Deborah Feldman. I mean,
right.
That's who.
Right. I just remember you seeing the similarities in the two of them. And I think at one point you put them side by side and sent them to me because I was so, it wasn't that I was adamantly against Deborah Feldman, but somewhere I read that, you know, Deborah Feldman was recovered. And I know for a fact that her recovery was not made public. And I don't believe they would have hid that.
I don't think she's been recovered.
In addition to talking about Deborah Feldman, Meg is telling you about a victim type called Betty. Here are a few of the candidates for this particular type that we were researching.
Deborah J. Feldman was last seen at her home in Hackensack, New Jersey on April 8, 2009. She has never been heard from again. Few details are available in her case. Deborah was 48 years old, 5'1" tall, 112 pounds. She had blonde hair and blue eyes.
Kimberly Ann Forbes was last seen on October 30th, 2004, at her residence in the vicinity of the 1600 block of Jeanette Road in Hood River, Oregon. She told her teenage daughter she planned to breakfast the next morning, October 31st, with a friend who lived 3 miles away on Wasco Street, then go shopping alone in Portland, Oregon, afterwards for flannel sheets and other winter necessities. She never kept her appointment with her friend and has never been heard from again. Forbes' burgundy 2000 Ford Explorer SUV with the Oregon license plates XTB679 vanished with her. The vehicle has a trailer hitch with a silhouette of a pig on it. On November 19th, over 2 weeks after Forbes vanished, the SUV was found abandoned in the parking lot of Don Pedro's Mexican Food in the vicinity of the 18,800 block of Southeast Stark Street in Gresham, Oregon, 55 miles from her home. Its rear passenger window was broken, and there was no sign of Forbes at the scene, but women's clothing and fast food containers were found inside and outside the vehicle, and credit card receipts were also found. The driver's seat was pushed back further than was necessary for a driver of Forbes' height. Investigators believe it was broken into after it was parked at the scene. Witnesses stated that it had been in the parking lot since at least November the 5th. Fingerprints found inside the SUV were matched to a Gresham, Oregon man who was questioned by police. He was described as being cooperative with the investigation. He admitted to breaking into Forbes' car while it was in the restaurant parking lot and stealing some items from it, but he denied having anything to do with her disappearance and said it appeared as if the vehicle had been broken into before he found it. The man agreed to take a polygraph in connection with Forbes' case. Investigators do not believe he was involved in her disappearance. Authorities searched Forbes' computers after her disappearance for clues. She has had many online relationships and had met at least one previous boyfriend online. Nothing of interest was found on her computer hard drive, however. Forbes is described as a reliable, very punctual person who would be unlikely to leave without warning. She was employed as a teller at the Columbia River Bank in Oregon and was scheduled to work on November the 1st, but did not arrive. Forbes was in good spirits the last time she was seen. There's been no activity on her bank accounts or credit cards since she vanished, and her cellular phone has stayed turned off. Forbes did not normally visit Portland alone. She preferred to take friends with her, but all of them were busy on the day she planned to go shopping. Her loved ones believe she met with foul play, possibly a carjacking. They stated that she would have defended herself if someone attacked her. Police do not believe Forbes left of her own accord. They too suspect foul play in her disappearance. Some agencies give the date of Forbes' disappearance as October 31st, 2004. Kimberly was 48 years old. She's 5'8" tall. She was last seen with diamond stud earrings. She's described as a Caucasian female with graying brown hair and blue eyes. Her case remains unsolved.
Wendy Marie DeHoop was last seen at approximately 7 o'clock a.m. on April 22, 2005, when she dropped her husband off at work at the Home Depot in the vicinity of the 1000 block of Green Acres Road in Eugene, Oregon. She was scheduled to drive to Halsey, Oregon for her own job at the Georgia Pacific, but she never arrived. She has never been heard from again. Her boss and boyfriend reported her missing. 6 days after DeHoop's disappearance, someone found her purse and dropped it off at a Bi-Mart in Eugene. He said he had found it while walking his dog. The wallet was also missing. On May 2nd, 10 days after DeHoop's disappearance, the same person who found her purse led authorities to her white two-door 1990 Toyota Corolla SRS with the Oregon license plate number YCH635. It was on Lorraine Highway, just east of Fillmore Street in South Eugene. There was no sign of DeHoop at the scene. Her case remains unsolved. Wendy DeHoop was 44 years old. She was 5'6" and weighed 145 pounds. She was last seen wearing a pair of black pinstripe pants, a suit jacket, and a silver band with a diamond cut design on her left ring finger. She has black hair and brown eyes. DeHoop is of African American, Caucasian, Hispanic, and Native American descent. She wears contact lenses. She has a pierced navel and wears a barbell in the piercing. Her ears are also pierced. DeHoop has a small circular mark on her mid to lower back and a scar on her lower abdomen. She may use the last name Williams, Williams Hook, or the nickname Nada. Nancy Kareen Moyer was last seen in Tenino, Washington on March 6, 2009. She worked as a financial analyst for the State Department of Ecology in Lacey, Washington. She left work at 5:15 p.m., drove a coworker home, and bought some items at a Thriftway market, paying by check at 6:45 p.m. This is the last time anyone saw her. Moyer's two daughters were visiting her estranged husband for the weekend when he took them back to their mother's home in the 700 block of State Route 507 on March 8. She wasn't there. The front door was ajar. The television and living room lights were on. There was a partially consumed glass of wine on the coffee table, and the bedside lamp in Moyer's bedroom was on. Her identification, purse, car keys, wallet, cigarettes, clothing, and toiletries were all in the house, and her car, a white Honda Civic Del Sol, was parked out front. She was reported missing at 5 o'clock p.m. on March 8. An extensive search of the home turned up no indications of a break-in or a struggle. Moyer does not own a cellular phone, and her credit cards and bank accounts have not been used since her disappearance. Her family stated she would have never left of her own accord and abandoned her daughters. She wasn't dating anyone or having any personal problems at the time of her disappearance, and she had no drug issues or mental illness that could explain it. She had worked for the Department of Ecology for 12 years, and her employers described her as a reliable worker who would always notify them if she had to miss work. In July of 2019, Eric Lee Roberts called 911 to say he wanted to confess to Moyer's murder because he was tired of holding it inside. When interviewed by police, he stated he'd been having rough sex with Moyer at his house when he accidentally strangled her with a scarf. Roberts was a coworker and neighbor of Moyer's. She was reportedly dating Roberts' nephew at the time she disappeared, and had supposedly visited Roberts' residence late at night on several occasions to meet with his nephew. But Roberts had claimed she'd never been at his house. Roberts had a prior criminal history for domestic violence. A former girlfriend of his told police he had a Jekyll and Hyde type personality and became violent when he drank alcohol, and that during sex, sometimes he would choke her to the point where she had to struggle with him and scratch him to make him stop. Another witness said Roberts had held parties on his property and people had gone camping there. But the parties and camping stopped after Roberts created an odd concrete structure on the property following Moyer's disappearance. Roberts' girlfriend said he'd poured a large concrete pad on the rear of his property and said he was going to make either a fort for his son or a man cave, which struck her as odd because there were no utilities running back there. She said Roberts had told her he'd had a sexual relationship with Moyer, something he denied to the police, and that when her mother asked him about Moyer's disappearance, he got upset and said, "What are you, the fucking police?" Police arrested Roberts on suspicion of second-degree murder and searched his home in the 16,500 block of Shelton Lane Southwest for 2 days, but they didn't find any remains. They stated Roberts told them he didn't think Moyer's body would ever be found and suggested they focus the search on his basement and in the area of the backyard fire pit. He said he'd burned the scarf he used to strangle Moyer. After Roberts recanted his confession, however, the prosecution said they didn't have enough evidence to file murder charges against him. He remains in custody on weapons charges, and the prosecution hopes to be able to file murder charges against him at a later date. Moyer and her husband had separated 2 years before, but it was an amicable breakup, and they worked out a shared child custody arrangement without involving the courts. He isn't considered a suspect in her case. Nancy Moyer was 36 years old, 5 foot tall, and 105 to 120 pounds. She had dark brown hair, brown eyes. Her ears and navel are pierced. She has a scar on her right knee. She has the following tattoos: an armband with stars, hearts, and butterflies on her right upper arm, a butterfly on her lower back, the words Doublemint and Juicy Fruit with flowers and hearts on her upper back, a hibiscus flower on her left hip, a Playboy bunny on her right hip, and cherries with the initials AS on her right foot. Foul play is suspected in Moyer's disappearance due to the circumstances involved.
And Nancy's case is a subject of the podcast Hide and Seek if you'd like to learn more information about her. And ultimately, this led me back to the nameless list. I wanted to see if there were any similar names on any of these dates, and I found one. The one that I found, I hadn't really looked at before. The name, odd, but the date was correct. In fact, there were two names: Justin Gaines from Duluth, Georgia, on November 2nd, 2007, and Jalik Rainwalker from Greenwich, New York, November 1st, 2007. And I had a November 2007 case that fit the Betty profile.
Brent.
Brandy Lauren Christensen, was last seen in Butte Silver, Bow County, Montana, on November 2, 2007. She's never been heard from again. A week after her disappearance, her blue 1991 Toyota Tercel with the Montana license plate number 1C8609 was found on Delmo Lake Road in Homestake Pass. It was undamaged with no signs of foul play, and women's clothing was in the back seat. There were no tire tracks in the snow around the vehicle, indicating it had been parked there for several days. Authorities were unable to search the area at the time due to bad weather. When they finally conducted a search in May of 2008, they found no clues as to Christensen's whereabouts. Christensen was a student at Montana Tech at the time of her disappearance. She lived in Butte, Montana, and frequently changed residences. She has three children and enjoys rock climbing. She had a restraining order against her former live-in boyfriend at the time she went missing, but he has not been named as a suspect in her disappearance. It is uncharacteristic of Christensen to leave without warning. She was 46 years old, 5'1", 102 pounds. Christensen may use the middle name Renee, the nickname Toddy, and or the alias name Doni Renee Christensen. Her case remains unsolved.
And there are additional candidates in this category, including Susan Powell, Shelley Mook, and some others that we'll cover along the way. I'm not covering them here because they come up for different reasons and because some of those cases are more publicized, and I don't want to distract from the fact that we're trying to get to the bottom of Deborah Feldman with this episode.
Well, here's how that went for me. Deborah Feldman is the only name on his computer. In the Google searches, she is the only actual name. We have all these images of missing people, media images, but she's the only name. And it's not Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, it's Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, Feldman. So for me, the first thing I did, I went back to WebCrawler, and I started looking to see, okay, we knew the age of the computer, less than 2 years, give or take, and we knew that he said one of the computers was going to be replaced. This one is on the tower in his house, and he's genuinely surprised when they say her name. That part is definitely genuine, either from the perspective of how do they know, or from the perspective of that's not possible. And he says he doesn't know why Kimberly would have searched for that name. That whole conversation gives me a lot of pause about like how we've been treating the words out of his mouth. I can't tell. I can't tell if he's lying or not. So for me, she's always going to be like forever a firm maybe. However, they take this conversation about this body in New York and the conversation about her, about Deborah, and they put them together in a way that if she is the body in New York, I think I know where that is. This is a mystery that could technically be solved, but with a lot of skepticism. And this is one of those things that upsets me because so with the Namus cases, the couriers are still on Namus because of how little was found of them. But he gives a really detailed account of the couriers. Like he nails down like exactly what happened to them. And it's pretty plausible, you know, like to me, I don't think there's a lot of BS in that, so to speak. But he avoids Deborah Feldman. He avoids talking about her at all. And so then we run into, like, is this, like, a rule? Like, there wasn't enough on the computer? Him, the way he asked about the computers makes me think that the tower was very different from what he was carrying in the car with him, and that he was only prepared to deal with the information of what was in the car. So Deborah Feldman, to me, wasn't supposed to be on there. And I wanted to know why. Why would that Deborah Feldman, why would that name, what else could it mean? And could the body in New York be someone else altogether different?
So first up, I'm going to play something. It's a little bit about skepticism.
On June 26, 2014, at CBS Detroit, Eric Thomas wrote, "Don't believe everything you read on the internet, and 6 ways to be more skeptical." The family of a 3-year-old girl who'd been mauled by her grandfather's dog cried foul when a manager at KFC asked them to leave because her injuries were scaring the other customers. Internet outrage swelled to a roar. KFC launched an investigation and pledged $30,000 to pay for the girl's medical bills. Social media called for prosecution, and donations flooded into a GoFundMe account to the tune of around $135,000. A week later, it turns out the entire incident was a hoax. KFC has not asked for their money back.
kudos to them.
The internet is awfully gullible. Poor Dr. Oz was called in front of Congress to explain himself last week, and many news outlets were forced to feign shock that his claims might not be based in reality. Of course they weren't, but still many people acted as though they'd been scammed.
Why are the American public so routinely fooled?
Hoaxes and hysterias have been around a long time. Snake oil salesmen, con men, and Ponzi schemes are in every corner of recorded history.
You might think that our access to vast oceans of information on the internet would change that, but it hasn't. In fact, skepticism is just as rare as any other time. Seemingly thousands of Americans are willing to believe something they heard second or third hand without subjecting their curiosities to even the most basic fact-checking. They seem to believe a single article, or let's be honest, a single headline the first time they read it, before they take that information and spread it to everyone inside their sphere of influence. People would often rather write than read. We'd rather be in the play than in the audience. We, as human beings, like attention, so we talk as loud as possible. We want other people to think we're smart and well-informed. Who among us isn't guilty of this? I can't even count how many times in a conversation where I've run out of facts and turned on the conjecture spigot. Of course, it sounds like I know what I'm talking about, but I've started sprinkling in a few hypotheses among the knowledge. Not when I'm writing, of course. I have Google and Wikipedia for assistance here. Don't believe everything you read on the internet. In fact, it's probably a good practice to not believe anything you read or see anywhere, and certainly never from a single source. If there is a subject or controversy that interests you, dig a little deeper. Read the counterargument. Read a few counterarguments. It's probably a good rule of thumb to read at least two arguments and counterarguments, but to be honest, that shouldn't be enough. Start a Google alert so that you can stay abreast of the latest news from the area that interests you, and or watch everything that comes along. Does this sound like too much work to you? If that's the case, then maybe activism and expertise isn't for you. It's very important to remain skeptical. Many people dismiss you as cynical, but that's someone who's actively trying to influence you. There are no awards for people who came to the conclusion the fastest, so take your time. Wait a few days. Don't form opinions based on emotion. Let it marinate a little before you pop off at the mouth. If news and the internet has got its blood up, then let them run around for a while before you join the mob. Here are 6 quick ways to keep yourself from becoming the mob. 1. Click the source links on an article. 2. Understand the difference between opinion and fact. 3. Beware of anecdotal evidence. 4. Ask a lot of questions. 5. Question your beliefs. 6. Turn to history. Do these 6 steps mean you'll never get scammed? Nope. But it's a good start. Friends and family might shake their heads and disapprove. They might call you a spoilsport or a cynic, but you're just not willing to join the herd in the gallop off the cliff. Understand that you're not an expert, and it's better to wait a few weeks before you charge into any direction. Skepticism is healthy. Listening and reading are more constructive than talking and writing. There is nothing wrong with admitting you don't know something.
Why all this talk about skepticism? Because someone in this case, particularly the case of Deborah Feldman, is lying. And the truth is, I've never figured out who or why. But one of the things I did figure out, there was an alternative to why she was on his computer, or why the name was on his computer. Those news clips I played about Deborah Feldman were from November of 2013. My web crawler searches, they turned up a number of Deborah Feldmans, all with active news items before his arrest. But from December 2011 until March 2012, right when the killer would have had these computers, there was a media blitz for another Deborah Feldman. This one, her name was spelled D-E-B-O-R-A-H, just like the Google search.
Hi, I'm Deborah Feldman, author of Unorthodox, and you've got to go your own way.
So then we have the other Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H. She writes this book, Unorthodox. She goes missing in 9 or 2010, and then writes this book. And the book gets published in February of 2012, so it's all over the place in January, February, and March. She's on The View, she's on CNN, she's on NPR. They do this big media press from Simon & Schuster about her book, Unorthodox. So this is a woman that went missing. She claims her mother disappeared. And she tells a story of a teen being killed by his family for being caught masturbating. And he has his penis cut off. So you got missing people. You've got this, penile amputation. It's a very salacious story. It's very scandalous, and it's in all the headlines.
From the New York Daily News in March of 2012, Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn blast Deborah Feldman's unorthodox memoir as pure fiction. Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn are raining righteous fury down on one of their own, a 25-year-old woman who left the faith and wrote a blockbuster tell-all
Since publishing her memoir, Unorthodox, The Scandalous Rejection of My Hasidic Roots, on February 14, 2012, Deborah Feldman had lived every writer's dream. She's been with Barbara Walters on The View, and the reviewers have declared her eloquent, and her story of a loveless marriage harrowing. The Satmar sect of Williamsburg, in which Feldman was born and raised, calls it something else. Pure fiction, especially an account in Feldman's book about a young teen who was slain by his father when he was caught masturbating. As Feldman tells it, the dad sliced the boy's penis off and let him bleed to death. And then the Jewish ambulance service helped cover up the crime, which took place in an upstate Hasidic enclave, she writes. The coroner's report tells a different tale. The teen died from an injury to the carotid artery, suggesting suicide. That claim is seconded by the New York State Police, Lieutenant Glenn Miner, who tells the Daily News the death was determined to not be a homicide. Feldman and her publisher, Simon & Schuster, stood by the book. I can only be responsible for the things I write. I cannot be responsible for what reporters write. Misunderstandings, misinterpretations, and just plain getting the facts wrong is common in journalism. But anything I sign my name to, I will stand by, Feldman writes on her blog. Other disputed facts include Feldman's insistence that her mother disappeared when she was a toddler.
For book stuff for like 3 months. And you got a killer that really likes to drive, like a lot. So my thinking is, and at this point, I'm not even thinking that it's necessarily him. It could have also been his partner living in the house with him, because it was sort of geared towards women. That being the correct spelling and that Google search being on a tower in their house makes way more sense than him having, for some reason, Googled one of his victims by name. For me to put it succinctly and to tell you why it's so interesting to me, it's just interesting that he only Google searches one potential or probable victim's names from the tower in his house. And he's not in the name of searches from his computer, but that it happens to be misspelled the way that someone who was in the news end of 2011, early 2012, happens to be, their name is correctly spelled the way the misspelling is occurred. And ultimately, you know, the body in New York is findable, so that would potentially end this particular mystery for me.
Story that kind of unfolds about the New York victim, okay? And this, there's a big gap of time that passes, and like he has so much apathetic disdain when he's referring to the New York victim and the questions that they keep asking him about the New York victim. He's so irritated that it's hard to read any of that stuff. But based on the circumstances, if somebody was killed, he's even said it. I mean, and it adds up as far as the bank robbery and you know, the other stuff that he did, it adds up. But like, and I believe, just like, you know, when I narrowed down things, I believe that Deborah Feldman is the only person it could have been.
Well, I am no longer arguing that it's not Deborah Feldman. Okay. I have two different theories that I'm presenting as I go. And this is, I think that period of time, there may have been more than Victor. And I will say, as far as Deborah Feldman goes and like getting your feedback on, I don't think I'm arguing it's not Deborah Feldman as much as I'm arguing that the killer didn't look for Deborah Feldman on his computer, not the victim. And that I'm wrong about that. And I'm, you know, if I'm wrong. I think that the killer was looking for something else. And that is just a really weird coincidence that he was looking for something else and that happened to be her name. And
Okay, that's fine. I mean, I get what you're saying there. That's fine. However, you know, I even wiggled trying to make things fit. If it's not her, who is it? You said there's multiple victims during that time frame. I can't even find one that's not Deborah Feldman.
Well, I have three victims that I think he's responsible for in a very short period of time. And that's sort of one of the emerging patterns that I'm starting to see is I think he killed multiple people a year, but I think he did it in such a short time period that seems impossible on paper.
Well, and I would not put that past them, but like there are certain verifiable facts for that particular time period, which is April of 2009. and he was in certain places at certain times. And I'm just curious where you found potential victims that were, you know, even at the extreme, plausible.
Well, what I did was I took him on a little road trip there. The gist of it is I do think potentially the victim that would be found up by Blake Falls, the one that he says there should be something there, I think that's probably Deborah Feldman.
In spite of her disagreements with me about this case, Meg kept working with me. As my mother would say, bless her heart. But the truth is, I never would have gotten to the end of this story without Meg. So I'm going to pause here and just say thank you for putting up with me through this particular disagreement and a lot more to come. But for now, I think the best thing that I can do is to play the interview here so that you can hear what it is that we've been questioning. First, here's that opening clip from the FBI again.
The serial killer Israel Keyes is at times seen smiling in 2012 FBI interrogation videos as he described or alluded to killing 11 people. Investigators now believe 48-year-old Deborah Feldman may have been one of his victims after his reaction to seeing her picture.
One of the photos that he was shown was a photo of Deborah Feldman. And when he got to that photograph, he made the statement that he didn't want to talk about that. He didn't deny it.
The Hackensack woman disappeared in April 2009.
Okay, I'm playing you that clip, and now I'm going to play you the interview, and I want to see if you get the same interpretation from this interview that the FBI did.
It's inevitable that this day comes, you know.
What day?
This day. This is the day where you say, give us more information or else, right?
No, I think things are going to move on. You know, things are going to move forward. And we've never been inconsistent about saying, if you give
I'm not faulting you for that. I'm just saying that is inevitable.
Well,
from my perspective, you have to understand that not much has happened.
And from our perspective, not much has happened. And that's why we're in a room thinking, can we make something happen?
Right. No, I see that.
Well, and you know, like you said earlier, progression's inevitable on this, whether you help us or not help us. And so things have to move forward.
Right.
From our perspective, our boss's perspective, things have to go forward. We would like them, all of us in this room would like them to go forward the way they've been going forward.
Right.
But they haven't. They've stopped. And so that's why we're getting pressure to move things forward the traditional way, even though we all may think that it's a moot point, but...
Well, why don't you talk about what New Jersey, you know, is doing?
One of the things that we've talked about from the beginning, we're going to keep you posted as to what's happening, so nothing is a surprise. Deborah Feldman, we had talked about her before.
Yeah.
New Jersey is looking into her more. FBI is looking into her more in that situation.
All right.
Thought maybe that'd be a place where we could start.
No, I mean, not as far as I'm concerned.
Well, what should we tell New Jersey? What should they tell New Jersey? You said to come to you. They're looking at things. What should we tell New Jersey? To know, you know, you said come to you. We told them we gotta go to Israel.
I can't help them if that's what you're asking.
Well, what do you want us to tell them?
I can't help them.
Okay, well, do you know this person?
No.
Can't or won't.
That's... No.
Is this the person buried in New York?
No.
Do you know where this person is?
No.
on your computer.
Which computer?
Mine?
Yeah, on your computer.
My laptop?
Tower.
Oh, Kimberly's computer. Yeah, I don't
understand.
You don't understand why the name was on my computer? Well, put it this way, there's a lot of names on my computer.
Right, but we're talking about this one.
I don't know.
Okay, when you searched her name,
we told you we'd do this, and we'd come back and try to get the information from you without going overt to try to get the information. And so we're just trying to hold up our end of the bargain.
Right. I mean, if you're referring to that, I mean, 2009, isn't that what you said?
April.
If you're referring to the New York trip, I don't know what you mean by going overt, because there wasn't anybody with me on that.
I just want to come over here with a clear picture. You know, are you responsible for her death?
No.
Okay. Do you know anything about her disappearance?
No.
Why is her name on your computer?
I don't know. Probably because I looked it up. I can't imagine why Kimberly would.
Does that image have any meaning to you?
Sure, but probably not on.
Well, just explain so we're not sitting here wondering.
No, I'm not. I'm not gonna talk about what's on the computer. I mean, if you, like I say, if you're gonna go out. I don't know what you're expecting me to say. I already said I'm not talking about any more specific cases until we get some kind of deal hammered out for something. Beyond that, the only concerns that I had when I said you're doing investigations was mostly, I was mostly thinking of people close to me and trying to bring them into an investigation. So, I don't know what you're saying. What if you're saying you're going to go overt, you're gonna, like, do a bulletin or something on that trip for 2009. First of all, I don't even. Seems like there were several lakes. I don't know. I don't know what you want me to.
In terms of this, they're going to start asking questions, is basically what it comes down to. And I think up to this point, my impression has been that you've been pretty honest about stuff. Usually, if there was something in the past that you didn't want to talk about, you'd just say, I don't want to talk about it. You wouldn't. And I could be totally wrong. My impression was, though, you didn't just directly lie to us and say you did something or you didn't do something. You just say you didn't want to talk about it. And so with Deborah, New Jersey FBI is asking questions, basically, because it fits. It fits. The date fits. The place fits. A number of things fit. And the fact that she's on your computer. So we're doing what we told you we were going to do, is come and tell you, hey, this is what's going on. If there's things that you don't want to talk about, hypothetically,
right.
If this were a victim and there were things that you did not want to talk about because we're not to that point yet, then okay. We're just asking for, are they on the right track? Are they not on the right track? And we can stop at that, or we can go further if you want to go further.
No, I didn't. I didn't kill her.
Okay. Anything else related?
No, I just didn't know if there's any. Is there someone else to the story that you're just not willing to talk about today?
I don't want to talk about it.
So I mean,
you seem conflicted with the answers. You're saying no, but you're kind of saying yes also, and so we're.
No, I never said yes.
No, but I mean you're.
Right. Well, I. You have to understand from my perspective. I realize now that you know a lot about things that I've done and places I've been on paper, and whereas I'm already in that respect, I already feel like I'm at a disadvantage. And I've thought back on some of our previous interviews, and I know that, you know, even though I never intended to blatantly lie, there have been some questions that I remember that you asked that I was. It was kind of a 20/20 hindsight thing. I think back, like, well, that's why they probably asked that. And in that case, you know, I kind of look at it from a different perspective, from your perspective, I guess, mm-hmm. as opposed to mine. Mm-hmm. My memory isn't, I've been finding more all the time, isn't perfect on all this stuff. So,
can you give us an example of something like that in the past?
No, I don't want to talk about it. I'm just saying if that sort of thing becomes an issue, then if there's any specific, you know, something specific becomes an issue, and then we can talk about it. But,
Well, one, let me give you what just jumped in my mind when you said that. When we were talking about Texas, we had long conversations about when you were in Texas and the arson.
Right.
When you were in Texas, you were talking about being really amped up.
Right.
During that period of time. That whole week we spent.
Yeah, we talked about Texas.
Talked about Texas and the arson and the bank robbery. And, you know, how you were feeling like you were going to rob a bank in one town and you were out looking for it, right?
Right.
Remember, you were sitting there and you were going to rob the bank in the town, but you were watching the fire.
Right.
And you couldn't go to that bank.
Right.
And that was in Azel.
Right.
And you buried some stuff when you were there too, right?
Yeah, there's. I don't. I know what you're getting at.
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, there's some things that I haven't told you about Texas, but that's not what I'm referring to. I was referring to things that happened years ago.
Because that's what jumped to my mind. I'm like, this Texas thing, there's more to the story. Like, we
right, that, you know, that's... But that's not the same thing. If I choose not to talk about something, that's not the same as giving a misleading answer that could be construed as a lie. I that's the point I'm trying to make. I've not been... There's a lot of things I've left out, obviously. There's... There have been some direct questions that I'm just saying my answers could have been construed as a lie or intentionally misleading, but that's not what my intent was necessarily. It's more of an issue of, do I leave it out? Do I talk about it at all? Or do I just give a yes or no answer that may not be the accurate? So that's what I was referring to. So, you know, you talk about the New York trip, that's the issue with that a lot, because I went in a lot of places, and several other trips prior to that, you know, there were several stop, different flights or whatever involved, so that's what I was referring to.
Sure, and we could lay that all out for you, but we're not gonna, you know.
No, I'm not saying that, I'm just saying, I remember the high points, if you will, but everything else involved, you know, the order isn't always crystal clear anymore. So that's something that I've been realizing more all the time as I try to talk about this stuff. It's not nearly as clear when it comes out of my mouth as it is in my head. So, and that was the case even with more recent things, you know, even the more recent things we talked about. So that's why I was saying, you know, if we're going to go back further than that, it's going to be... You know, that even just locations and stuff.
Yeah, and we can, and you know, we can get you your records to show you where you were at different times.
Right.
We can help with that. No one's trying to trick you off, but we are trying to make sure that we don't leave any misleading impressions with the things that you said.
You should write it down.
Yeah,
and we'll be happy to share with you what we have.
You can share just fill with in the blanks.
We can tell
have.
You where you flew into, the car you rented, and where you drove, and you just have to fill in the blanks. It should actually be pretty easy for us to work together that way.
So what? I mean, there's something more to the story. Just so I'm clear, there's something more to the story of Deborah that you just don't want to tell us now.
No, I just don't want to talk about it.
But I'm right about that.
Yeah.
And that seems like a good stopping point for part one of this episode. But what did you think? Was he lying? Or was he telling them the truth? Was the FBI lying when he said he didn't deny it? This is one more step in the investigation that was really, really important. On the next episode, I'll take a look at alternatives to Deborah Feldman and alternatives with Deborah Feldman. Thanks for joining me today. Today's episode is brought to you by labrotticcreations.com, labrotties.com. With the code CRIMEXS, you get 20% off one of their custom pop pet portraits. Be sure to check out their other merchandise at labrotticcreations.com. You can reach me at truecrimexs@gmail.com or 252-365-5593. You can check us out on Instagram or Patreon, all at True Crime XS, or our website, truecrimexs.com. If you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast app. Today's music is Indestructible by Noah Smith, and today's sources include Yahoo News, the New York Daily News, AOL.com News, and the Charlie Project.
This is True Crime XS.
And that's another thing that I'm so upset about is American Predator states in the source notes or notes on their sources, you know, and it's crazy because we do owe a lot to American Predator. We owe a lot to the publisher and to Maureen Callahan herself, because otherwise we wouldn't have a lot of these documents available to us. Although now they're sort of being dumped into the FBI vault, meaning they're not really looking at them anymore. Don't consider them to be open investigation case files, which is a whole nother issue. So we do owe that to them. But her saying that the FBI was comfortable naming her, Deborah Feldman, as a victim, and then referencing that her body had been recovered in New York really threw me off, because his conversation about the body in New York, he says, like, there should be something there. And that was one of the first big things to me that, like, tipped me off as to where the bodies were. Because if you throw a body in a river or a lake, you're not going to find it again. Not like, well, you might. And, like, I could be totally wrong. Maybe it's just in the water there. But I don't think so. I don't think that one is in the water. That's 2009. He's amped up. The solution that we came up with from the maps, that's the best one.